Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As the brother said, we nothing formal now, but open floor for anyone to ask any questions. And in my limited abilities and knowledge, I'll try to answer them as I can. One brother had asked a question about, are there actually 30 people who have claimed to be prophets? As the prophet had mentioned, that there will be 30 Dajjalin. And the word Dajjal, actually, that was mentioned in the hadith, it means someone who plays a trick with the people. In other words, he's a person who misleads the people. So not necessarily it would be the person who claims to be a prophet. Someone claiming to be a prophet, there were many of them, and probably they will include to be 30 or more than 30. Who knows? Sometimes the prophet may mention a number. It might be, 10 or 20 or 30. And sometimes it means specifically that number. And sometimes you mention it just like as a round figure, and it may be that there are more. But there were, for instance, in the time of the prophet himself, there was Musaylama al-Kadhab, the one who was from Yamama. And he was the famous one who came, and then he went back to his land, and his people accepted Islam. And when he went back to his land, he claimed that he has half of the world, and Quraysh has other half, another Muhammad. And so the Prophet, called him the Kadhab, the great liar. And many of the people that followed him, they knew that Musaylama was a liar. They knew he was a liar. But they were pleased to have a liar from their own tribe rather than having a truthful person from the other tribe. And this is the reality that we have to always remember. Many people know the truth, but they do not want to accept the truth in their actions. They do not want to leave the vested interests that they have, which if they follow the truth, then they'll have to give up those vested interests. Some people even said that, yeah, your Muhammad is true and your religion is good, but that means I have to leave, my girlfriend and my liquor, and I have to leave, change my job because it's haram, this kind of stuff. And people, they actually sometimes come to the point where they know things are true, but they have a hard time leaving their way of life. Another person was Aswad al-Anasi at the time of the Prophet. He was from Yemen, and he claimed to be... Excuse me, it's not coming through? Okay. That's right. One of the other... Okay. Yeah, bismillah, yeah. The brother had asked me about the number of the people who had claimed to be prophets in Islam. Do they fulfill that they are a certain number? And actually, it's still open. There's going to be many. The Prophet just mentioned that there will be many. And there were, at the time of his life itself, there were five. There was Musaylama al-Kadhab, I said, who was from Yamama. And then there was Aswad al-Anasi, who was from Yemen. And Fayruz al-Daylami was able to actually do a trick on him and pretend to be part of his friends and then get close to him and then at night to slaughter him. And actually, and then there was also Sijah al-Asadi, a woman who claimed to be a prophetess. And she actually married Musaylama al-Kadhab. And they have many stories that when you read those stories, you'll actually laugh when you read those stories, but we won't get into those details. And then there's also, because it was so foolish, some of the things they said were so outlandish that even the people around them, they knew that these people are just, playing games and they're outlandishly fools. But nevertheless, as I said, the tribalism was so intense that they followed the people from their own tribe against the truth that came to them. Then there was also Tulayha al-Asadi. And he is the one who who actually, although he claimed to be a prophet, and he fought against the companions of the Prophet after the Prophet's death. He eventually turned back to Islam and became an upright Muslim. And he actually had a role to play in the Futuhat, in the conquests of the Romans and the Persians. And so he had a good ending, which shows that someone could do something, the worst crime in the world, and then he can come back to the truth. There's no worse crime than associating Allah, partners with Allah in worship, in saying that Jesus is the Son of God, because God does not have any sons nor daughters. But so, if anyone can do the form of shirk, then to claim to be a prophet and to have a certain kind of, excuse me, certain kind of revelation is also another form of sin. Then at the time after the Prophet, in the time of the Tabi'een, of the followers of the Prophet, there was another man called Mukhtar ibn Abi Ubaid al-Thaqafi, the brothers who were in the morning, I spoke briefly about him. And he is the man who the Prophet mentioned actually in a hadith, although he was a generation before him. He mentioned that in the tribe of Thaqif, there will be a liar and there will be a tyrant. And the liar was this Mukhtar ibn Abi Ubaid al-Thaqafi, and the tyrant was Yusuf ibn Hujaj al-Thaqafi. And this man has many, many stories. And it's interesting. He claimed, when I mentioned in my speech, that there will be a man who will claim to be of me and my family, but he is not of me and my family. Some ulama mentioned that the reference is to Mukhtar, because he claimed to seek justice for those that murdered Hussein. And so his first action was to go and take the people who had murdered Hussein and to start killing them one by one by one, and collecting an army to do that, until finally he took over all of Kufa. And slowly, eventually, he started to claim that he has the wahi, or he has revelation coming to him. And when it reached the Ibn Umar that Mukhtar is claiming to have revelation, he said, it's true, but there are two kinds of revelation. There's a revelation from Allah, and there's a revelation from the shaitan. And he's having the revelation of the shaitan. And similar other stories. Then down through history, of course, at the time of Bani Umayyah and Bani Abbas, there are others who claimed to have to become prophets. Of course, in our era too, there's a man in Nigeria whose name is Matisi, Abdullah Matisi. If there are any brothers from Nigeria, they know that this man had created a great fitna. And one time in Nigeria, in the 70s, people fought in one of the northern towns of Nigeria, and thousands died because he was claiming he had a bunch of followers and he was claiming to be a prophet. And here, I think everyone knows about the Baha'i faith and the Babiya faith, where that man claimed, not only did he claim to be a prophet, but he actually claimed Godhead and godlike qualities. The other famous example of nowadays is Ahmed Qadian, the leader of the Qadianis. And not only, he's also a man, he claimed first to, he did a series of claims. First he claimed to be a great leader, then he claimed to be Jesus, to be Mahdi, and then he claimed to be Jesus, and then he claimed to be a prophet. And actually, there are sayings that he even claimed at the end of his days that he had some kind of Godhead and deity. And also, the other famous example nowadays here in America even is Elijah Muhammad, and who he claimed to be a prophet, and then he also claimed that Farid Muhammad is God incarnate. Similar to the Christian belief that Jesus is God incarnate. So there are many people. I mean, right now I've mentioned maybe maybe seven or eight. And if you go through history, I mean, I remember that there was a man who claimed at the time of Abdul Malik, the Umayyad ruler, and he took him. He sent him to the gallows, or he killed him for that claim. And it's interesting to note that anyone who claimed to be a prophet, they all met death. Almost all of them met a violent death. And this is the reality, that if someone claims godhood or someone claims prophethood, then this is such a great sin that it's something that it is the greatest sin. So they all, Allah Subhanahu wa Ta'ala takes His anger upon them from the hands of the Muslims, or through some other source, and they meet a violent and ugly death. Also, I guess I should mention the leader of the Five Percenters. He also is a famous man here in America who claimed godhood. But that's a similar kind of thing, similar to some of the Christians who claim that we are all the children of God, in the sense they all have a similar kind of strain going through them. If there's any other question, then I'll ask it to Fadal Afi.
Regarding the emirship, and what's the reality like in this time? We don't have a khalifa, and we understand the hadith where if we have three, we're supposed to appoint an emir. But specifically, I'm curious about, like, there's a specific at Jama'ah which they appoint an emir, and I was wondering if it's allowed for him to be an emir in all of your affairs. I mean, disregarding the other details of that Jama'ah, but for example, if someone is out in that under the authority of that emir, is it allowed for him to leave that, you know?
Okay. Actually, you have a few questions, so I'll try to pull them apart one by one. The first thing is that, of course, as I alluded to, and I didn't want to get into it, but our religion is built upon a chain of command, which is... Excuse me, I'm sorry. The question is about the fact that we should have an emir and we should have a khalifa. And there are groups that sometimes they appoint an emir among themselves, and then you, the people who have done some kind of allegiance to him, they are supposed to obey him. And how? What are the perimeters of their obedience of that man? Is it in a general sense or a more absolute sense? I think this is some of the ideas that you're getting to, paraphrasing. So I said this is a bunch of questions actually. The first question is that generally I should say, and I had mentioned that and alluded to it before, that our religion is very, very clear that there's a chain of command that we have. When Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا أَطِيعُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُوا الرَّسُولَ أُولُو أَمْرٍ مِنْكُمْ وَإِن تَنَازَعْتُمْ فِي شَيْءٍ فَرُدُّوهُ إِلَى اللَّهِ وَرَسُولِهِ إِن كُنْتُمْ تُؤْمِنُونَ بِاللَّهِ وَيَوْمِ الْآخِرِ ذَلِكَ خَيْرٌ وَأَحْسَنُ تَأْوِيلًا. That all you who believe, obey Allah and obey the Prophet, and obey those who are in command among you. And if you differ in anything, then refer it back to Allah and His Messenger, if you are believers in Allah and the Last Day. That verily is the best interpretation, and that is the best affair, or as Allah has said. So, we have a chain, it's very clear. And as it is mentioned, the obedience to the leader, any leader, who he may be, it's all conditional upon his obedience to Allah and his messenger. There's a famous story where the Prophet sent a group of people out, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, to do an errand in the form of attacking a certain group or scouting out in the jihad, in the warfare in the way of Allah. And this man was from the Ansar. And he told the people to obey him. So when they went out, somehow the group of people that were following him, they got him angry. And so he got furious. So he took a bunch of, he told them to all collect wood. So they all went out and collected wood. And they said, okay, build a pile and light that wood. So they made a big fire. And so he said, didn't the Prophet order you to obey me? And they all said, yes. So he said, jump in the fire. And so they all looked at each other. And they all said, wait a second, we only followed the Prophet in order to escape from the fire. We don't want to jump in the fire. And so they just sort of like were standing around wondering what's going to happen. And then finally the fire started to become smaller and the person's anger subsided. And then they went back to the Prophet and they asked the Prophet, oh Prophet Allah, this is what happened, such and such and such and such. So the Prophet said, if they had obeyed him, they would have never come out of the fire. If they had obeyed him and jumped into the fire, they would never have come out of the fire. Verily, the obedience of the obedience of a created thing or person is conditional on his obedience to Allah. So this makes the idea that any leader, if it is a father or a mother or an emir in any sense, that the obedience to him is only if he enjoins that which Allah has enjoined in the book or the Prophet. Or it is in one of those mundane kind of things which help for the success of the group. Like for instance, if you're in a group, and as you mentioned, the tradition which says that if there are three people, if one person is traveling, he is like a shaitan. And if there's two people traveling, he's like two shaitans. And if there's three people, then they are a group of travelers in Islam. So they're ordered to travel as a group. And if three people travel together, they have to make one of them as their amir, as their leader. This is the order of the Prophet. So what is that for? Because if they go out and there's no amir, then they may have differences of opinion and they would not complete their objective because of the differences among them. But if they have one person who is the leader, then he will order them to do this. Well, let's go now. Let's pick up our trash here. Let's make this and let's make that. And so it will become an organized affair. This is also the reality in jihad. Also the reality in Hajj or any other affair. And this is the training that we have also. And as we also know, there's a chain that the husband is supposed to obey Allah and is supposed to obey his Amir, his leader, and the wife is supposed to obey her husband, as there are many traditions that mention this this idea, and all the children are supposed to obey their mother, and even greater, and so on and so forth. So there's a chain of command which is very clear, and this creates a society which has obedience and obeying the commands which are good, that is very, very strong. Different from the societies that we live in, where people always want to do what they want and they don't want to obey anybody and they have their own ideas of how to do things. The idea of having a khalifa and the fact that we do not have a khalifa, this is another issue. The Prophet ﷺ mentioned that, that I was with you and there is the khalafa, there is the, the Prophet was with you for as long as he was, then after that there will be a time where there will be khalafa nubuwa, and that will be for a certain period of time, and then that will be lifted. And then there will be a khalafa mulkan aadhan, which is like a traditional kingdomship. And then there will be mulkan jibriya, which is like a tyrannical kingship. And then after that there will be khalafa nubuwa. And this is the sequence that the Prophet has mentioned that will happen in our ummah. And when we look at that this is the reality, that there was the Khulafat al-Rashideen, Khulafa al-Rashideen, which was Abu Bakr and Umar and Uthman and Ali and Hassan. Actually, and Hassan, for he was the Khalifa for a short period of time, and then he gave up his legitimate right to Muawiyah. And so Muawiyah became a legitimate king. But as he used to say, that I am the last of the Khulafa and the first of the Muluk. And he also realized that because he passed the authority on to his son and forced the people to make bay'ah to his son. And he did it for some reasons which may have been legitimate for him, because he said that he thought that people were not going to obey someone other than his tribe or from him and so on and so forth. The people of Ahl al-Sham, since he had been an Amir at the time of Omar and the time afterwards for 20 years, and then after he became the king and the Khalifa of the Muslims, he was also for 20 years. For 40 years he was the Khalifa, and he was very honest and just and so on and so forth. So he thought that if it left his family and left his tribe and such, it would cause dissension. So this is some of the reasons why you can see why he did what he did, because the times had changed. The only point is that started the sequences which happened at the time of Bani Umayyah and Bani Abbas and so on and so forth, and the various kingdomships that came down. Eventually, they became more and more tyrannical, until we have the last one, of the Khulafa of the Uthmaniyin, and then that was finally disrupted. And then we have other kings and governments, some of them military governments, some of them truly very, very tyrannical, non-Islamic governments. The fact that we have to go back and have a Khalifa, no one denies that. The fact, and how do we do it, that is also a question. There is the idea that there can be imara, which means that if someone is in a land and he is a Muslim and the people around him are Muslim, then of course, as I said, because they're ordered, if there's three people, we make one of yourselves Amir. And then what do you do if you become the Amir and you have the people who are Ma'mur, the ones who are obeying, that whenever a judgment comes upon you, or whenever there is a conflict or anything to be judged upon, what do you judge according to? You judge according to the Quran and Sunnah. If you're attacked, then you help each other and you defend yourself against attacking, and so on and so forth. So this imara, the imara that happens, then they have, in a sense, that he's not claiming that he's the Khalifa over the entire world, because he only has jurisdiction over the area of the group of people that are following him and the land that they actually own or control under their feet, But nevertheless, that imara has a certain amount of legitimacy, as we can see, because of what the Prophet had ordered. It's not the Khalifa, and there should be a Khalifa over all of the Muslims, and all of the Muslims are actually, they are sinful, for not appointing one person to be the Amir of all the Muslims. So all the political leaders that we have now, whether they are Muslims or non-Muslims, and that can be a debatable point, because a lot of them are doing certain acts which are showing them to be either hypocrites or to be those who are non-Muslims, or if you say they're good Muslims, they're tyrannical Muslims or whatever they're doing. But nevertheless, all of the Muslims should try to appoint or put into place a movement which will create the Khilafah Nabuwah. And we have the glad tidings from the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam that eventually there will be this government. If it will come at the time of the Mahdi, in the time of the descent of Jesus alayhi salam, Isa, then at least we know that at that time it will happen. Will it happen previous to that? I think I mentioned a little while ago in the hadith that eventually there will be a series of tribulations. And the last tribulation, the Prophet said, was that then the Muslims will migrate, in a sense, or to two different camps, a camp or a tent that has belief without any hypocrisy in it, and a camp that has hypocrisy and not any belief in it. So it didn't say kufr, but it said hypocrisy. In other words, they have the outward appearance of being Muslims, but actually their actions will speak that they are doing, that they are actually hypocrisy. And this is the reality of people who are Muslims, and yet they are doing forms of shirk. They may have big, huge beards and wear Islamic clothes, and maybe even making five salats and paying zakat and doing sawm, but because they are doing forms of shirk, then they actually are speaking iman and faith and not acting faith. This is some of the answers. I didn't fulfill all of the answers, so maybe you can restate one of the answers and I can give it more specific.
I'm sorry, is there a connection between like the Khalifa and the Emirship and the scope of that Emirship? Because I was under the impression that, for example, that Emir, when you're traveling, is pretty limited. In other words, he might not have the right to go legislate all over all your
affairs. Of course not. It's as you say, it's a limited jurisdiction for the actions that he's appointed for. Just like if you had a person and he's one man is the janitor and one man is the head of the junior high school and one is the head of the college and one is head of the medical department and so on and so forth. Each one is in a sense an emir of that which he has jurisdiction over. That's mentioned in the hadith that kullukum ra'in wa kullukum mas'ulun an ra'iyatihi. Which continues to say that you all are like a shepherd or like a leader of his flock, and each one is responsible for his flock. The leader over all the Muslims is responsible for all the Muslims, or the general Amir al-Am is responsible for them. And a man is responsible for his family, and a wife is responsible for his husband's children, and the children, and a slave is responsible for the property of his master. And this is the hadith. It says that the chain is very clear. There's a chain of leadership and a chain of command and obedience, which is very clear. So, of course, it only means for the jurisdiction of a certain thing. We can realize that the political realities that the Ummah happened is that actually during the Abbasid Khilafat, certain groups broke away. I mean, there was Andalus, and Andalus was the remnants of the Umayyads who had fled to Andalus, Spain, and they had the great civilization of Spain. Now, no one says that Spain, that they were all illegitimate 100%, because as long as they were ruling by Islam, ruling by the precepts of Islam and worshipping Allah and not performing acts which make them go outside the fold of Islam, then they are legitimate Muslims and their regime has that amount of legitimacy. They're not of the status of being Khulafa al-Rashideen, but they're of the status of having the Muluk, either a Mulk al-Ad or a Mulk al-Jibriya, either a kingdom which is a traditional hierarchy and kind of kingdomship, or a tyrannical government. But we could say in the Abbasid similarly had this similar kind of system. The Fatimids, for instance, many of them considered them illegitimate. Why? Because they made false claims to be from the daughter of the Prophet Fatimi. And because they had certain belief system which was extremist of the Shias, they hid those beliefs, but eventually they became Agha Khanis and they became Buhra. I mean, the train of imamate travels from Agha Khan nowadays all the way back down to the Fatimi and so on and forth. So the beliefs of the Fatimis was the seed of that original thing. And Agha Khan, of course, if you know anything about Agha Khanism, that he claims to be God in God on this earth, like there's a God in the sky and there's a God of the earth, and so on and so forth. And the Buhra, also have similar extremist kind of claims, such that all of the ulama have claimed them to be outside the fold of Islam. So, as I said, some group might be considered to be illegitimate and some legitimate. But here we had a claim of, we have two different governments, both having a certain amount of legitimacy. And then other groups started to splinter off them and splinter off them until we know that this is the history of the Muslims.